Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And we're going to spend the rest of the hour here talking about what it means to reform the prisons and our correction system in the state of Maryland. We saw the recent trial involving the Black Gorilla family and women who were guards at that jail, a federal trial. And we see the new head of corrections in the state of Maryland, Steve Moyer, saying he's going to get into this and delve into it quickly and find out what's going on and reform the prison system. Well, I've been in and out of working in prisons most of my life. And I've been covering this issue for the last 23 years here on the Mark Steiner Show. And it's clear we're nowhere near an understanding what it means to reform a correction system in this state or around the country. And I've interviewed every correction secretary we've had in those 23 years. So what does it mean to reform the system? How does that really work? What are we looking for here? And we're going to wrestle with that particular issue and look forward to talking to the new commissioner soon, I hope. Let me introduce our guests. We have with us in studio Harold Bailey, advocate for formerly incarcerated people, a former Open Society Institute fellow after being incarcerated in the Maryland system for 20 years and partnering with Turk House Recovery Centers to provide services for formerly incarcerated males. Harold, good to have you back in the studio.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Dominique Stevenson's in the house again, Program Director for the American Friends Service Committee, co-author with Eddie Conway of Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther, and who has been involved in work inside of our prisons for 20 years, more?
Not quite, but close.
A long time. Let's just say a long time. And so she joins us here in studio. And speaking of Eddie Conway, he's also in the studio. Eddie Conway, of course, served 43. I said 27 because we were thinking yesterday of Nelson Mandela, who did 27 years in prison. That's why it was in my head. 43 years in prison. Is a free man now and now producer for the Real News Network here in Baltimore and is in studio as well. And Israel Quezon's on his way here, should be joining us as well, who did time in our state prison system and is president and founder of I Can't, We Can. And you all join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here by email, talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, but please call in 410-319-8888. So, you know, we hear this question all the time of reforming the system. But do we really even know what we mean by reforming a criminal justice system? What does that mean? I mean, how do we even begin to define that idea? We have seen incarceration rates jump in this country to just absurd numbers. And here in Maryland as well. Dominique, let me start. I mean, I'm sorry, only because you've been in and out as a worker. You've been tied to this institution in that way from the American Friends Service Committee. And you have an interesting analysis of where we are. So I'm curious, what does it mean to you when people talk about reforming this criminal justice system?
Wow. That question is actually very difficult for me. One, because like on an ideological level, I believe that we actually need to really abolish the system. But I do understand that we are nowhere near the point of abolishing prisons. And so in the interim, there need to be reforms. But I think that we have to really, one, that stuff has to happen outside in the community. We need to really look at what people are going to prison for. You know, the answer to changing the prison system really exists outside. It's a matter of resources and resources not coming into certain communities and those communities also being targeted aggressively by police. Those things are all contributing. The so-called war on drugs just became an excuse to really target those particular communities. And so I think that in order to really deal with that system, we have to deal with the conditions that are happening in communities that are sending 17, sometimes 16, 15-year-olds into these systems, into, you know, the prison system.
Let me just get you – I have another question about what goes on inside, but let me get you all to kind of comment on that as well. Harold, what does that mean when you hear reform? I mean, without major political intervention, the way Dominic is describing it may be hard to do, but what does prison reform mean to you?
Well, it should be holistic outside, as Dominique referenced, but also inside. Research indicates the first 72 hours post-release, good decisions or bad decisions can be made. So individuals that are incarcerated should be exposed to the services that are available prior to them coming out so they can hit the ground running. It takes a lot of inner resolve to not go back to former criminality.
Eddie?
Well, personally, I think you know, from looking at the kind of work that we've been doing in the prison system. I think one of the ways in which to reform the system is to unblock that bottleneck in the system. The system doesn't do anything to, quote unquote, rehabilitate individuals while they're in there. It doesn't take advantage of the resources that are available to help younger, newer prisoners that come in the system. There's a tremendous amount of conscious, progressive people in the prison system that mentors, that work constantly to decrease the violence, to change attitudes and ideas among the prison population. Those resources are being squandered because they are being locked in a no-win situation. They can't make parole. They can't get out in society to help the community. So when you talk about reforming the system, you have to also talk about the system is not trying to reform itself in a sense of using those resources. It's not trying to allow people to grow and develop, and instead of rewarding people for doing positive activities inside the prison system, it in fact locks them down. It keeps them in. And one of the my pet peeve is that the parole system, the parole board, every year recommends parole for a large number of prisoners that are eligible, but those prisoners denied every year because the governor don't want to participate in the parole process, although by law he's mandated to sign off on the parole board's decision when it comes to parolable lifers. But those lifers are the very people that are working with the younger prisoners. They are the very people that could be beneficial in the community, and they're the very people that younger prisoners look to for role models and examples, but yet they see them locked in the prison system and never getting a chance to be released. And so younger prisoners, or newer prisoners, as it were, don't have an incentive to modify their behavior or to learn different behaviors or find a way in which to address their issues in a different manner, because they don't see any benefit in changing that behavior. Because when they look at people that did in fact change their behavior and did in fact get recommended for parole, and then every year they see those same people year after year after year, decades sometime, it creates a bottleneck at the top of the system, and it also creates a lack of a belief in that change is possible or that it's beneficial.
So, and I think that there's a lot of components here. I want to come back to these individual components. In Israel Case, I'm welcome. Good to have you in the studio with us as well. Always good to have you here.
All right.
We need to get Israel's mic up. Thanks. But it's one thing I have to ask the three of you here, the three men in this room here, because every person listening to this program, because of the news that is in the headlines right now, is at the top of people's brains. Let me put it on the table so we can deal with it and get it out of the way for a second, which is the Black Gorilla family and the power inside the prison. I made a comment the other day, and you can say, Steiner, you don't know what you're talking about, or Steiner, you may be right, or have your own ideas. But I said, you know, I don't care if this was 1930s, 1940s, when you had a lot of Irish, Italian, and Jewish gangsters going to jail, or whether it is the 1990s and 2000s when we incarcerate lots of Black and Mexican people in this country in jail. And that once inside the prison, cats who were out in the street before who were gangsters are going to be gangsters in the prison. And they've always had that power inside. This is like nothing new. It's not like this is some revelation that this never happened before, that guards bring in dope and guards bring in alcohol and then slide a woman or two in if they can or whatever. That this is like, we're making out this is something new and powerful, but it's really been part of the life of prisons since we've had prisons. Is that a fair statement to make?
I agree.
Yes.
Israel?
Yes. I mean, this
That's how the prisoners run the prison, actually. And most of the people, especially in Baltimore, the correctional officers are from Baltimore. So it's they part of the culture that's in the prison, and they do the same thing.
I mean, because I think we kind of make this shocking kind of revelation that this is happening, but I wasn't so shocked when I heard that this was going on. Just, I guess, shocked that they actually caught somebody who was in the middle of it rather than anything else. Anyway, what do you think about as I said that?
Well, I'm sorry, I have to disagree.
Brother, we've been friends for a long time, but go ahead and disagree.
Prisoners, in fact, don't run the prisons. Prisons are run by officials, and they're run by the people that control the guns. If prisoners ran the prisons, prisoners would leave. Why? Yes. Why the hell would you be running something and then you control it and you don't go and open the door and walk out? No. Prisoners are allowed certain activities for the guard force to maintain control. They are allowed the use of various drugs or whatever, because that allows the correctional officers and the administration to control the prison populations. They are allowed to organize and form street organizations or gangs, if you will, because that divides and conquers us, and it allows us to control Building C in Hagerstown, say, or Building A, X street organization is in that group, or Building 8, X organization is in that group, and those people are maintained by the group organizations in that group and this group. And so if this group gets involved in something, they can shut them down or they can move on them. These things have been going on since Rome built prisons. You look at Spartacus or you look at gladiators, you look at prisons. Prisons have always been ran by society, and they're run by society to contain people.
So what you're arguing is this is interesting. What you're saying is let's take what just happened to the Black Gorilla family. So your argument would be that the whatever control BGF had in their world was a limited piece of control people are allowed to have, so greater control to take place from the outside. That's what you're saying,
That's always the case, even in the case, believe it or not, of the mafia in the 30s and the 40s and whatever. The control they had was limited to the ability to interact with the people that controlled the means of production. When Rockefeller say, do this or do that or don't do this, if this group didn't cooperate, the powers of that be will turn on government agencies and destroy that group. If this group got out of hand and wasn't in compliance, forces were applied to that group and it was destroyed. And another group was allowed to come up. And when you chase that dope money or when you trace that racketeer money, you trace it all the way up. It goes back to Bank of America. It goes back to Chase Manhattan. It goes up all the way up to the ruling class.
So let me pick up on that point. So if you take that analysis and you look at what's happening in the prisons today, so and you think about what the public may be missing and what we may be missing in these debates in the state legislature and around in terms of what to do about what's going on in prisons. Let's take that analysis if we would. Maybe you all will disagree. That's fine. But take that analysis and figure out how that's used to change where we are and change how things are managed. People who commit certain crimes are going to be locked up. I mean, now we're locking up people for all kinds of insane things, or nonviolent crimes people probably should – not probably, but people should not be in prison for. Then there are people who have committed crimes and they're separated from society because the crimes are violent and people are fearful of that. But all that notwithstanding, what should happen inside now that changes the nature of imprisonment and how we manage that system in this state that we could do?
Well, really, there's nothing you can do in the prison. It had to start outside the prison. Prison is already set up, and try to reform prison would the people that's coming in, that's what the prison is for. It had to start changing the way the people, the behaviors of the outside that's going inside. There's no cure for learned behavior.
I disagree with that. I do agree, like I said, that this is the roots of it are outside, and we have to really do something about what people are going to jail for, and we have to deal with the conditions and communities that set people up to go into the prison system. But what I've seen, like one of the things that I've known is that there has been basically an agreement in the Jessup Correctional Institution where folks are not being stabbed. Now, there may be violence, there may be fist fights, but folks are not, you know, using knives, okay? Those things are happening because you have people negotiating those kind of agreements. You have people within the prison system who are attempting to make peace, who are attempting to help others transform and change their lives. What you have is, one, administrations that don't acknowledge that, that don't give credit where it's due, that don't support it, that are suspicious of it. I mean, we were banned because I accidentally took a floppy disk and put it in a metal detector in a prison. They treated it like I was smuggling drugs. To me, the root of the issue really was the fact that we had Bloods, Crips, BGF, Muslims, Christians, all of those folks in one room, and we didn't have conflict. And so I think that there are things that can be done, but I think that the things that can be done are happening by people who still don't have power. And so at any time, an administration can pull the rug from underneath a program. The programs that the young guys inside seem to respond best to are those programs that are run by people who clearly get respect in the population, who clearly have transformed their lives. There are a minimum of those type of programs in the prison system. Most of the programming is religious programming or Narcotics Anonymous. I'm not saying that that's not necessary, but there needs to be more. Also, this notion of public safety, we really need to change that. There is no public in public safety. We found that out when we were banned, that the public is cut out. People attempt to go see their relatives. They're being subjected to fingerprinting. So a lot of things are happening that need to be undone. You're taking 16, 17-year-olds. You're putting them into this environment. Then you're cutting them off from their family. Well, what are they going to do? Of course I'm going to go in the gang. That gives me a sense of family ties. It gives me that sense of family that maybe I didn't have. So we need to look at how folks are being treated. What are the impediments to people really changing their lives inside? And change that and really get serious about it.
Let me just say, we have to break back, a very quick break.
We'll come right back, and you gentlemen can jump right back into the mic, and we'll get to these phone calls coming in at 410-319-8888. Let's see, on our way to break here, we are listening once again to Jay Dilla, who passed away on this day in 2006. Back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's A Day in the Life by the Beatles, recorded on this day in 1967. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or at SteinerShow.org, there is the Maryland State Education Association's website. And we are here with Harold Bailey, Israel Quezon, Dominique Stevenson, and Eddie Conway talking about what we mean by changing the nature of corrections in our society and our state, given what just happened with the trial with BGF and corrections officers, and the new statements by Stephen Moyer, who is the new head of corrections, who, by the way, said he's brand new, couldn't come on today, but is willing to come on the program to talk about that. We're looking forward to that conversation. And before I jump to a question and get to these calls coming in, gentlemen, you were leaping into the last part of the conversation. We had to go to break. So Harold and Israel, take off.
Well, the state of affairs in most prisons currently, and has been for quite a while, is warehousing. Prisoners, they most that want to change their lives have to self-direct their rehabilitation. And the term that Eddie used earlier, he referenced rehabilitation, that is to restore someone to their former functionality. If you have a juvenile that's been incarcerated, has never worked legally in life, you don't want to restore them to that former state of affairs. So rehabilitation would need to be implemented for those youths.
And when we talk about prison reform, we have to see what that looked like, you know, because prison reform means a lot of different things to different people. And to the government officials, prison reform means something different than the people that's just trying to help the people that's in the prison, to different organizations. So there's no one, when you say prison, everybody's saying prison reform, but what do that look like? And if everybody have a different perception of what prison reform is supposed to be, then that's why I'm saying there will never be no prison reform, because everybody's coming from a different perspective, and it means something different to everybody.
So I'm going to explore with you. It is true, and I'm going to explore with, how we get to that and what that means for a popular conversation within the state for people to begin to maybe think about how things could be different and bring those conversations beyond the politicians to the people. Let me go to the phones first, and I'll come back to a question around that. 410-319-8888. Sataria, you're on the air.
Hello?
Welcome. Hey. Yes.
Hey, this is Paul out of Baltimore, man. I just had a couple questions and a comment.
Go ahead.
First, I'm going to make this comment. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm 23 years old. I live in Baltimore, Maryland. And I come to the realization that these prison systems and these jails, they, you know what I'm saying, it's like a modern-day slavery. You understand? It's like a modern-day slavery, you know what I'm saying? Like, they sent us to prison specifically to work. You understand? It seems like it's been set up. You know what I'm saying? We've been targeted to go to jail and to go to prison just so we can work for pennies on a dollar. You understand what I'm saying? That's just my perspective of it all. You know, that's just my comment. The question I had was, you said it was a brother in the studio that's with the Black Panther Party, right?
It was what? A brother in the studio who was what? I didn't hear that.
He's in the Black Panther Party.
Well, he was, yes. Eddie Conway, right.
Yeah, I got a comment about that. To that brother. Hey, what has letting white people join the Black Panther Party, how has that benefited the Black Panther Party?
The Black Panther Party doesn't exist today. It ceased to exist in 1982, so it hasn't been operational for the last 32 years. So if you want to talk about the history of the Black Panther Party in the 60s and the 70s, we organize and we work with all kinds of people, Latinos, Native Americans, Asians, white people, et cetera. But that was during the 60s and the 70s. So I think maybe you are making reference to some other formation now, maybe the new Black Panther Party. But the Black Panther Party in its original form ceased to exist 30-some years ago.
All right. Do you have a second question before we move on, Satira?
Like, what is your, this is a question to everybody in the studio, in general. What has joining the so-called white man, you know what I'm saying, it's February, it's the so-called Black History Month. What has joining hand-in-hand with the so-called white man benefited Black, Hispanics, and Native Indians, as you just mentioned? Black.
Okay, well, we can chat that for a minute, but we're really just trying to focus in on corrections, and this is something that beyond where the conversation is going. Though I will give you a prison analogy that I remember when I was younger, that when the rebellion took place in Attica in upstate New York, where dozens of inmates were mowed down by the state police as well as correction officers who were being held hostage by people who took over the prison, were all killed by the police when that happened that day, that was a coalition inside that jail of Black, Puerto Rican, Native American, and white prisoners who did that together, and which is a lot part of what Eddie, I know, was doing inside of Jessup and other places when he was organizing, when he was inside for those 43 years, was crossing every line and every kind of so-called street organization boundary and more to bring people together. So that's a conversation for another day. But so let me tackle this from a different way. There are people right now, like Angela Davis and others, who are saying the prisons should be abolished. That's their perspective. The prisons should be abolished. And there are others who are saying the prison needs, our prisons in the society need drastic reform, that there's nothing inside for the men and women inside that can help them carry a life once they get outside again at all. There used to be. I mean, there used to be college education. There used to be every kind of trade you can imagine. That stuff is all gone. And then there's a third issue of some people saying, look, you might say to people who want to abolish prisons, yeah, we shouldn't have prisons like this in America, but there are some people, for whatever reason, that have in the society and the oppression of society have become very dangerous players in the community. They got to go somewhere. What do you do with them? So I want to really wrestle with tackling from these really basic bottom-up issues. What do we do? How do we address those issues?
One, I think when you get down to talking about abolition, that has to come from the community level. A lot of times activists and folks can speak on it, and this is no disrespect to what Angela Davis has said, because I really respect her work and the fact that she's kept the whole issue of prisons alive when people wanted to ignore it. But I think that when talk of abolition, it needs to be those discussions need to be had in communities, because communities need to be able to decide what to do with Junebug if he did something offensive in the community. You know, that should be up to folks who, in a sense, have been harmed by that particular action. And so that's why I said we're light years away from that, because right now communities are simply under attack, and they're not necessarily dealing with that attack upon youth and how youth are very often criminalized. And I think I wanted to go back for a minute to what Israel said. I think that point is important, that what I may think of as reform, another person may not see as reform. And I struggle with even reforming that system, because it's such a harmful system, in particular to Black folks, to Latinos, to poor folks. It's been so harmful to our communities that I struggle with the notion of reform. I'm more committed to really helping people transform their lives, mm-hmm. so that they can change the conditions in the community, that they can change the conditions within the various prisons that they are in. But I really struggle with the notion of reforming that system.
Well, really, it's a system in place, but it's not being utilized properly. From treatment instead of incarceration to probation to minimum security to medium security, maximum security, and it's not being followed, because they're just putting people in, and most of it's political, and they're just putting people in jail or in prison and not following what the guidelines that they set up for. And certain people have certain, you know, like crack cocaine and the cocaine, the disparity in the time that people are getting, and then the culture of different people are being put in different places that not going along with the system that's set up. So it's not the system has a way of dealing with incarceration, but it's not following the guidelines.
And what do you think those guidelines are that aren't being followed?
Well, it depends on where the person lives at, or where the person go to court at. You know, like if some people don't need to be in prison, they may need treatment, but they put them in prison. And then some people may not need to be in a maximum security jail. They may need to be in a minimum security. Some people may be in a halfway house. Some people may need, but they're not taking the time out to separate these people.
And I think, you know, I'm thinking about what you and Dominique just said, Israel, and I want to tie them together for a moment. I think this is some of the ways that we're not thinking about alternative ways that the society could act. And even though we are light years away, as you said, Dominique, a moment ago, there are the things that are real examples of how these things work outside that we're afraid to implement in our communities. Let's take, for example, there are all kinds of interventions happening that people like Lauren Abrams and others in community mediation move into that we don't do. In other words, if a young person is, let's for example, a young person breaks into somebody's house or snatches a car, or takes them out of the car, rather than going to jail, what that process does is bring the entire community in, the family affected, the family, the young person, the family of that young person, community members, to sit and work together to work out what should be done to that and how the community wants to handle it. Do those kind of things, finding alternative ways of addressing it rather than always thinking about the only way to address something is to incarcerate somebody and put them in prison. Remembering we have a multi-billion dollar prison industry in this country that wants people incarcerated so they can make some money. So that's a piece of it too.
And the state of Maryland is probably 15th in terms of states that actually benefit.
What do you mean?
From when you look at like profits from telephone calls and things like that, okay, uh-huh. They get a cut off the top of that. So you look at how high or the the price of the phone call, say, from Hagerstown to Baltimore is at least, I think, $9, if not more, okay? The state is, I think, getting maybe 40% of that. I mean, so it's beneficial to the state in many different ways, and we have to really look at that. Those are some issues that friend of a friend has brought up for the past few years.
Let me bring up, unless anybody wants to jump in, I'm going to go to the phones here. Is that right? 410-319-8888. Let's go to Dave in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Great program.
Thanks, Dave.
And Israel and Eddie, I commend you. These are persons that have been in prison, and Eddie's comment about Bank of America, I mean, I suggest to you all and your listeners Piper Kerman's book and a great list that's in the back on all kinds of alternatives, but it's rearranging chairs on the deck of a Titanic. I mean, Piper, Eddie, I don't know about Israel myself. We've been in prison, and reform, and prisons are not going to be abolished. Thank you.
Okay. Also Harold's been inside as well, so we have three gentlemen here who have spent time inside those prisons. They are not going to be abolished tomorrow morning, but I'm interested in how you push the envelope.
Well, if you look at different places, all prisons not ran the same. It depends on the people, the culture of the people, and what type of people. They're putting people in prison, and if you don't have money, you're going through the system, and it really don't matter. People don't matter to anybody in the system that don't have any money, because they just go through the system, and then their record is messed up, their life is ruined, and they're forced to go back into society, and they have no other way but to continue to go back and forth to prison, because they was duped from the beginning. It could have been something minor that turned into a major crippler, and it could have been avoided from the very beginning. And this is what happens, especially in the black community. They lock you up and keep you in jail for God knows how long before they give you a public defender, plea bargains, and once you plea bargain, then now you can't appeal it. You got to deal with that the rest of your life, and people are getting classified as sex offenders because they're taking a lesser charge, and so your life is ruined.
That's the broader question of the American judicial system, which many argue is not about justice or fairness, but about money and power and influence, what Israel referenced. If you cannot make bail as a prisoner and you appear at a bail review hearing shackled to nine other individuals in state-issued clothing, there's no doubt going to be a different result than if you can make bail and you appear in court with a paid lawyer.
I mean, it is stacked.
And, you know, I just want to add,
Eddie, go ahead. Then
you know what I have been hearing, or the collective consensus is that restorative justice is one of the ways to reduce the amount of people that's incarcerated. Meaning, just what everybody on this panel and you have been saying is that the community needs to come together. The community needs to decide what harm has been done. The community needs to decide how to address that harm, and so that person can make the community whole, but so that the community can make that person whole also,
right?
And develop. And there's programs, the restorative justice programs around the country, and being applied in a white community, affluent communities, et cetera. We don't use those apparatuses that's available to us, whether it's treatment programs, whether it's counseling sessions, et cetera. Instead, we take young, poor, and people of color mainly, and slam them right into the prison system and start that process Israel is talking about, where from then on in they're stigmatized and then they can't restore themselves. They can't even reinvent themselves because they are labeled, they got a box on them, they et cetera, you know. So one of the main reforms is to take that whole restorative justice piece and see why we can't have a component of that before people get in the system.
That's what I was trying to say, and you said it much better than I did, Eddie, which is the idea that, and what you said at the very beginning of the program, Dominique, which is we have to start from the outside. It's not just a question of reforming what's inside. It's reforming what's outside. There doesn't have to be an inside the way it exists in today's society. And you were saying that as well, Israel, that you're not reforming these inside the prisons. It's beyond that, because those institutions are almost insane to turn around, but you can turn around the outside. But that takes community action. Let's see what our listeners think of 410-319-8888. Let's go to a couple callers in a row here. We have a lot of people calling in. Who's been waiting? We'll do this in order you called in. Curtis, West Side, you're on the air. Curtis, the West Side's hung up. If you're not there, then we'll go to Dick in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello, how you doing?
Good morning, Dick.
I want to say about the prison system. Isn't it written into the Constitution that as long as you are incarcerated, you are a slave? Like 13th or 14th Amendment or something like
13th Amendment.
So slavery in the prison system is never going to go nowhere because it's designed into the structure for slavery still to be here. So with the way they're going to the prison system, like you said, we got to reform on the outside in order to keep them from going inside. So as long as we keep going inside, slavery's still here, because there's more people incarcerated on parole, probation, and things like that that were actually slaves back in the day.
So that's true.
Getting branded with that felony is what's holding everybody back, and not allowing us to really get what we need and do what we need. Because once you get that felony, you can't do nothing.
It is. I mean, I think, and that's a true fact that you threw out there, that there are more people incarcerated in prison today that were enslaved in this country in the 1850s.
But see, we don't want to talk about the elephant that's in the room.
Go ahead.
Majority of the people that's incarcerated, percentage-wise, is black people. And I know it's from when I was coming up in Baltimore back in the 60s, we went to prison at 16. Murder State Penitentiary. All the rest of the counties up to 18 were adult. We had to take the whole state to the court to sue because only in Baltimore,
right,
where the minority was the majority, we went to court. We were adults at 16. And that started feeding the prisons way back then. They didn't find it unconstitutional until around 69 or 70. And then they had to let people out that was incarcerated 15 to 16. We went straight to the penitentiary. We didn't have an opportunity to go to training school or boys, but we run juveniles. We was classified as adults. But that's happening systematically all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we're dealing with, it seems like it's a people that's targeted, and everybody else just being affected by this targeting of the people.
And that is a very critical, powerful point.
Yeah.
410, do you want to say something before we go to the phone, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the points that the caller brought up is true. I mean, you look at Angola in Louisiana. That was a plantation.
Right.
Okay. It's also named Angola because that's where most of the people who were on that plantation came from. This stuff is clear. It's been brought out a lot. But I think one of the key things is that it often gets pushed to the side as if it's just an issue for black folks. This system affects everybody. This is everybody's issue. Okay. You look at who's sending these kids, because 16 and 17-year-olds are still going into the adult system. In our group, had a 14-year-old. So you have in Hagerstown right now in MCTC many 16 and 17-year-olds, and even some as young as 15. That stuff is still happening. But it's not just our issue. This is everybody's issue. Everybody's impacted by this.
And there's another stat. Just put this in perspective. We'll go back to the phones here. We talk about slavery, but if you look at the history of the world, there are more, and I read this morning, there are more people in correctional supervision in this country, more than 6 million people, that were in the Gulag archipelago under Stalin at its height. More people in correctional supervision in the United States of America than were in the Gulags of Stalin's Russia.
The fact is, this America, which is 5% of the world's population,
has
incarcerates 25% of all the prisoners in the world. That's a fact. So there's something systemically wrong with the arrangement in America where it has to incarcerate 25% of the prisoners of the whole entire world.
And half of them are us.
And
right.
And more than half, because us is, when you look at people of color, you're talking about 75% of the prison population of people of color, you know. So there's something really wrong with the arrangement, and it's the economic arrangement that's causing that population to exist like that, when there's 200 countries in the world and one of them is incarcerating 25% of the prisoners in the world. Something's wrong with that one country, apparently.
Yes. So let me go back to phones here. But what this also says, in many ways, this, we've had this conversation numerous times in the Mark Steiner Show over the years, and it comes back to this reality that we're talking about right now. We'll never reform anything unless we address the reality we're talking about here in the studio at this moment. 410-319-8888. Donnie on the West Side, you're on the air.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Donnie.
Hey, I always tune in. I always enjoy the conversations you guys have. I read a book on the topic, and I think I've heard you speak about the book as well. The New Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander.
Yeah, she's been on the show before, yeah.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. The book was so thoroughly written, because at first I said, hey, Michelle, you're reaching maybe some conspiracy theories, because she got into, you know, systematic racism and the privatization of prisons and how the funding for police, if they do so much arrest here or if they can do this over there, they can get all of this funding. So the young fellow that was just speaking before me, he says, yeah, there's something wrong. No, there's not anything wrong, actually. It's designed just to be the way it is. It's something wrong on our behalf that we haven't taken up action. And I won't say that, because there are many people who are doing things about it. But there's nothing really wrong from the standpoint of America or the U.S. or whatever. It's designed to do what they're doing or whatever. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is. They're going to continue to incarcerate. They're going to continue to... To me, it's still a caste system.
Oh.
And we find on the low end of the totem pole. And unless, you know, again, back to Michelle Alexander's book, and many other great writers who address these issues or whatever, unless we, I guess it's got to be a grassroots type of startup or whatever. Myself, incarcerated by the time I'm 17, I'm 40-something now, federal prison for 12 years, just a revolving door for me. And it happens to many other people like myself, but it's important somewhere along the line we got to stop thinking that they're going to do something for us to help us out. If we don't help us, Mark, we're going to be in dire straits, and we already are.
Donnie, thanks so much for that call. I think that the Donnie was getting to the point here we've been talking about for most of this hour, that we got to get to the root and heart of this. It's not just about – this is important, because we sort of have the question of prison reform, but it's not just about reforming the system. It's about changing the nature of society, if anything is really going to change. While we're out here doing our best to save individual human lives, there's something deeper than that that has to change for anything else to change.
Well, that's lifestyle. Some people are forced to live in a certain lifestyle. And if the lifestyle don't change, prison is part of that lifestyle. So you have to begin to change. It starts with prevention with the babies. You know, they build a prison now. It's not for people that's grown. It's for children that ain't even born yet. But they're building the prison and expecting them to fill it with babies that they haven't even been born yet. So they already projecting that they're going to have to it's supply and demand. They're going to have to build a prison. They're going to have to fill it. They already projected how they're going to fill it. They ain't investing in no prison and for people that's not even born yet and don't expect them to be in there.
Eddie?
Yeah, and you know, the problem is this, and what you're saying is absolutely correct. But here's what happens. You get that 13-year-old person and he gets harassed on the street corner because he has no recreation facility. He has no employment future. And so he's there on the corner. He's entertaining himself with his buddies. And the cruiser comes up and slams him up against the wall or sets him on the curb. And he pulls his arm away. He gets a resisting arrest. He starts along the juvenile process. He's angry. He's hostile. Maybe he's got a single parent. Maybe his one of his parents is already incarcerated, he's doomed to a life of imprisonment because he's touched right there on the street, singing on the corner, and from that point on, he's flowing through the system. And his brother sees that, and he ends up being touched and flowing to the system. And you got to go the extra mile in order not to be part of that prison population that will fill up those prisons, because the system is designed to snatch those young men and women now straight off the street corner if they're in poor neighborhoods, if they're in neighborhoods of color, or even if they're in poor white neighborhoods.
So first, let me make apologies to Wanda, Mary, and some of the others who couldn't get through in this conversation. There's many people calling in. This has inspired a lot of people to have this conversation. So I want to thank my four guests here. Eddie Conway, I'm glad you walked in the studio. It's always great having you in the studio to join this conversation.
Okay. All right.
Dominic Stevenson, always good to see you. Thank you so much for the work you do, as well as Israel Case on Harabelli. Thank you both for coming in here today and making this conversation work.
Thank you.
Now we just got to make the society work. On our way out of here to our next to the next conversation in the beginning of our sound bites, I want to remind you to join us Thursday night at Red Emma's at 7:30, February the 12th, for the screening and discussion of the film Food Chains, about the Immokalee workers in Florida, the farm workers fighting to improve working conditions, and the food that we eat and how we're connected to all that. We're going to have a panel discussion afterwards. It's co-sponsored by the Baltimore Food and Faith Project of the Center for Livable Future and the Mark Steiner Show and the Center for Emerging Media. More information at redemmas.org. So join us for that and come on down and be part of that. We're going to head out of here in this break with Long Tall Sally, Little Richard, recorded on this day in 1956. We'll be right back.